Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. California's newest state park in a decade will open up in San Joaquin Valley. Ahead on Insight, we'll learn what Dos Rios State Park, located in Stanislaus County, has to offer for both visitors and wildlife. Also, the Supreme Court heard arguments on what some are calling the most important case about homelessness in decades. We'll break down the legal arguments, as well as how it can shape the way California responds to homeless enforcement and whether they can clear people sleeping outside. Finally, an exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum is telling the stories of tattooed women across California's history. We'll learn more about tattooed and tenacious, as well as its connections to the Sacramento region. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. But first, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California has a new state park. It's called Dos Rios, and it's located west of Modesto, between Highway 99 and Interstate 5. Dos Rios is the 281st state park, and the first to be dedicated in a decade. But aside from that, Dos Rios is one of only a handful of state parks and recreation areas in the Central Valley, a region that doesn't have many options in the immediate area. If you live in Modesto or Stockton, you usually have to drive a big drive, a significant one, if you want to visit a state park. Dos Rios is now just a short drive away. Yesterday, on Earth Day, Governor Newsom officially dedicated Dos Rios to the state park system as a unique space that provides a natural spot for migrating birds and lots to take in for outdoor lovers. It officially opens to the public on June 12th. Joining us now about this new jewel of the Central Valley is Armando Quintero, director of the California State Park System. Welcome to Insight. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ms. Gonzalez. It's so good to be with you.
So for our listeners who may not be familiar with this exact area, can you describe exactly where Dos Rios is?
Sure. If you're driving south on Highway 99 and you're passing Modesto and look off to your right, you'll see acres and acres of ag land. And if you're driving south on Highway 5 and look to your left, you'll see acres and acres and miles of ag land. And Dos Rios is right out in the middle of that. And it is where the Tuolumne River, which originates in Yosemite, and the San Joaquin River meet. It's only about 15 minutes west of Modesto on Highway 32.
I imagine that's where the name Dos Rios came from, two rivers.
Precisely. That's exactly right.
You know, I also heard the name Dos Rios Ranch. Is that the proper name or is it just Dos Rios?
That's a great question. It does not, this new unit does not have a proper name yet. It was a ranch, and 11 years ago, River Partners, a nonprofit group, purchased it from the Lyons ranch family. And what they've actually done is restored the landscape of this 1,600-acre area back to native vegetation. And so in a way, what this park will be is a return of a lush Central Valley natural landscape where for the last 100 years it has been ranched. And anyway, that's what it is.
Yeah, I read that this is the largest public-private floodplain restoration project in California to essentially restore that habitat for threatened and endangered wildlife at the Tuolumne and San Joaquin Rivers. So this seems like it's a significant deal among, you know, more than 200 state parks that already exist in the state.
It really is. And in this time of the need to find new places to store water, a floodplain actually means that what that does in this case is when we have heavy rains like we've had the last few years and the waters and the landscapes flood in areas like this, it actually recharges groundwater. So this is a park where not only will there be recreation, but it'll actually be adding to the water supply that California so sorely needs.
Given that it's been a decade since we've had a state park, what goes into finding and designating a state park?
It's a great question. We're always looking for opportunities for new parks and additional lands that we can add to parks. And there's an ongoing list where the priorities shift. When the governor asks that we look for the next park to nominate, we sent a team out into the Central Valley where they located a number of areas. And what we were looking for in this instance was a place that would serve a Central Valley community, because when you look at state parks or a map of state parks of California, it's like a necklace around the state. It's all along the coast and then up around the base of the mountains to the north and to the south. But the Central Valley, which just has such a huge population of Californians and a population of Californians that really serve the rest of the world with all of the agricultural work there, really doesn't have a lot of parks. And so that's where we looked. And we identified a number of areas, but Dos Rios rose to the top in terms of being the new park that could offer water activities and shade in times of heat events. So it was just an amazing combination of opportunity.
I looked at that map that you just touched upon, and right, that necklace of state parks around California. And California has some of the most diverse landscape, you know, in the country, if not even outside of the country as well. And when I looked at that Central District region, I really saw Calaveras Big Tree State Park, which I have been to. But as you say, there's not really much else. This is also a unique area in terms of landscape. You know, what is special about the Central Valley?
So, you know, the wetlands of California, what this really is we're going to see a return of an ancient landscape in California where it really looks like the savannas of Africa, you know, where you have millions of birds during the migrating season. We're already seeing beaver and river otters returning to this area, and native species are starting to return without anybody having to reintroduce them to the area. Deer have shown up, and there's of course raccoons and fox and all kinds of creatures that are already returning. But I think what this really will give all of us is an opportunity to walk into a time of the California Central Valley from 200 years ago. And it is really a different world. And so I'm thrilled about the future for Californians.
What did the state have to do? What goes into acquiring the land? Was funding needed?
It's a great question. The River Partners actually were able to get 19 investors 11 years ago to purchase the property from the ranching family. And over the last 11 years, River Partners has been doing all of this restoration work. And when I approached them and said, hey, we'd be interested in making a state park out of this, how much would it cost us? They said, we'll give it to you.
That's nice. Free is nice.
Well, give it to the state of California. Well, they'd already raised a lot of money from philanthropists and from various government grants and had done all of the work. And so what this really offered was the opportunity for state parks to already begin to put in the improvements for visitor amenities. And so it really is it's really a jump start that you don't usually see with a park.
So this big moment happened yesterday. The governor on Earth Day went out to Dos Rios and officially designated it within the state park system. But it officially opens to the public on June 12th. What happens between now and June 12th?
We continue to work on basic services that will be available for the public. And when the park first opens, people will be able to do some hiking. There's there's shade structures, and we have restrooms and things like this. And it's a time when we'll be able to orient people to the area. But we're about to start a public planning process where we're going to be inviting the public to come in and take a look and say to the public, what would you like to do with this? Because that's how parks are actually created. It's through public engagement. And so we're going to be holding meetings and various workshops to see how we plan out the future of this park.
Would people, once they actually can go to Dos Rios, will they need a reservation?
Not initially. And all of that will be rolled out in the coming months in terms of information of A, how to get there, and B, what it will take to get in, if anything. And the parking areas have already been developed. So we're already ready for the public to arrive, but we just want to do some more work to actually make it a really safe, a safe visit for visitors, because there's a lot of work that we had to do since there's actually two rivers and a large pond or small lake. There's something actually called a bow tie there, which is when rivers curve in their normal life, what happens every now and again, those curves end up being so sharp that they meet each other and then pinch off a part of the river. And that will become a small lake. So it also, you know, includes a small lake where people can fish and things like that.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Armando Quintero, the director of the California State Park System, about the dedication of their newest park, Dos Rios, which is located in Stanislaus County, just west of Modesto. How did you become connected to the state park system and really where your love of the outdoors? Where did it come from?
As a child, we did not go to parks. I'm the oldest of eight kids, and but I like to do artwork. And it was drawing birds and things like that that led me to an interest in nature. I ended up becoming a national park ranger in 1976 and worked with national parks for 22 years and ended up teaching and doing other activities after that while I actually was a home dad with my two daughters, who were 3 and 5 when we started that adventure. And I ended up working at the University of California, Merced, in the Valley for 12 years. I was executive director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute, and I also got involved with water. I was on the local water board where I live in Marin County, and Governor Brown appointed me to the California Water Commission as well. So I got really connected to the world of California in the world of parks, public lands, and water. And in 2020, I received a call from the governor here, governor's office, and they appointed me as director of state parks. And it is a dream that I never thought I would realize.
Often our experience or our love for the outdoors, I mean, a lot of it has to do with proximity. And when you touch upon, you know, equitable accessibility for everyone, that has been shifting and that's become a larger part of the conversation in recent years, whether from the National Park Service or with Dos Rios now with the California State Park System. You also have an initiative called Outdoor Access for All. How does that fit into getting more people exposed to the outdoors in an equitable way that's reasonable for everyone? Because it can be costly.
Absolutely. A few years ago, we initiated 3 pass programs. So you can go to any public library and with your library card, check out a pass. It'll get you into a park for free. Anybody who receives Department of Social Services support is also eligible for a free pass. And we also have a 4th grade adventure pass, which is very similar and free. We're doing that, but we're also getting information out on how to access not only the state parks in your area, but state parks as a department has invested billions of dollars in California communities who are park poor to build local parks for them. So it's actually state parks through the legislature and the governor and through bond initiatives. We have built, as a department, have built playgrounds, recreation centers, and all kinds of facilities. We're trying to get the word out on that so people realize that it may be that you have an investment in your own town that connects you to the giant sequoias and the coast of California. And it is all yours. And what I like to think of is that I really want Californians, when they think of a state park, to think to themselves, this is where I live. Where these things are, this is also where I live. And so there's a bit of, you know, I'd like to see a sense of ownership in people's hearts and minds and also the physical access. And all that together will make a big difference.
Director Quintero, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That is California State Parks Director Armando Quintero talking about the newest state park, Dos Rios, which is located in Stanislaus County, just outside of Modesto. It officially opens to the public on June 12th, which is also State Parks Week. We have more information on our Insight page. Up next, the Supreme Court heard arguments on what some are calling the most important case about homelessness in decades. We'll break down the case. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Homelessness in the United States hit an all-time high last year, and California understands this reality more than any state in the country. Of the estimated 650,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night in the United States, 180,000 are in California. Our state accounts for nearly half of all unsheltered residents in the country. California has invested an unprecedented amount of funding in recent years to address the complex, deep-rooted causes of homelessness. But one tool in particular has been controversial, and that's enforcement. Since 2018, California and western states have been in this murky area when it comes to removing people on public property. A Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling known as Martin versus Boise essentially ruled that clearing unhoused residents without adequate shelter space to offer amounts to cruel and unusual punishment, which is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. Since then, public and elected officials across party lines have growingly asked for more legal clarity, and they're finally about to get it. The Supreme Court just heard a case that is challenging that 2018 ruling, and it is considered the most important case about homelessness in decades, Johnson versus Grants Pass. We're going to better understand the legal arguments as well as how this could impact California cities and counties. First, we'd like to welcome Leslie Gilo Jacobs, an Anthony Kennedy professor at McGeorge School of Law, who also served as a law clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Louis F.J. Powell, Jr. Welcome back, Professor Jacobs.
Thank you for having me.
So Martin versus Boise has been brought up a lot in the debate surrounding homelessness. On the surface, it seems simple. Someone has a right to sleep outside if there's nowhere else to go, and removing them is cruel and unusual punishment. But what the Supreme Court is deciding is more nuanced. Can you unpack that?
Sure. Well, and we're talking about whether the Supreme Court justices are going to interpret a right into the Constitution, not whether homelessness is a big policy problem. Everybody agrees with that. But do we have five justices on the court who are going to do that? And so what we have going on here is the cruel and unusual punishment clause. So we also have to look at the part of a constitution we're talking about. And this was written initially thinking about the sentences, and they couldn't be cruel and unusual. In other words, they were the punishments. But we do have a case that the Supreme Court decided many decades ago saying that California couldn't declare the status of being a drug addict to be a crime. And so that's what's at issue here in the first place, is whether what the city of Grants Pass is doing here is effectively declaring homelessness to be a crime and declaring a status to be a crime, and that the Constitution should forbid that.
Given that oral arguments took place yesterday and you listened to them, what struck you about how the attorneys on both sides argued their positions?
Well, it's not surprising how the attorneys argue the position. That is, the prime question is whether this city is actually criminalizing homelessness or whether it's criminalizing conduct, because that is how you, when you read the ordinance, it is a bunch of different types of conduct. But the argument of the advocates is that these are all the conducts that behaviors that homeless people need to engage in. So certainly we saw a focus in the argument on that. But we also saw a focus in the argument on whether it is appropriate for the judges to find a constitutional right here that will limit the discretion of states and cities to deal with a big public problem. And so any time that the court interprets there to be an individual right, it limits the scope of democracy. That's just how it works. And so the question here is, should the court do that? And do we have five justices who are inclined to do that?
We do have a conservative-leaning court, of course. How did the justices respond?
Well, I would say that there certainly seemed to be a divide out there. Our 6-3 divide was in evidence with the three Democratic-appointed justices making the point that it looked like indeed the status of homelessness was being criminalized here, and the making points about the unfairness of that, and at least a couple of them inclined to find that there is a right. But then I do think that we see the other justices, Republican appointed justices, not inclined to do so. I think the question is not whether they're going to reverse the Ninth Circuit decision. I think the question is how broad or how narrow they're going to be in doing that.
Given that a decision is expected sometime in June, in just a few months, I mean, you just touched upon this right now. It's not as simple as reversing an appellate decision or keeping the appellate decision, which means there's a lot of options in how this could go. I mean, we don't have the decision yet, but after what you listened to yesterday during oral arguments, how do you think this ruling could go?
Well, as I said, it could be broad or narrow. Frankly, what could be at stake, I don't think the justices will go that way in this case, but really the way of interpreting the cruel and unusual punishment clause could be at stake. That is, Justice Kennedy was the fifth vote, along with more liberal justices, to adopt an evolving standard of decency way of looking at what cruel and unusual punishment means. And so he, with the other justices, held it to be cruel and unusual punishment, several things having to do with capital punishment for juveniles and for people with mental disabilities, and then several other things as well. And so a number of the Republican appointed justices don't like that standard and would simply look back at history and say, well, you know, back in the 1700s, what was cruel and unusual punishment? And that's all it is. That would be a very broad ruling because it would affect more than homelessness. It would affect capital punishment and other sorts of punishments. But we could have more narrow rulings. That is, the ruling that says that you can't, the cruel and unusual punishment says you can't criminalize a status. Maybe there are five justices who want to overrule that and say, no, you know, cruel and unusual punishment only applies to the sentences, not to the definition of the crime. And that's, in fact, what the city of Grants Pass argued. But then there are more narrow grounds. That is, what is the definition of involuntarily homeless? The Ninth Circuit adopted a ratio approach. If you don't have enough enough beds for your number of homeless people, then you can't enforce these regulations. So maybe they will adopt that more narrow rule of saying, look, we have to look more carefully or require an individualized determination of whether people are involuntarily homeless, as opposed to a big, broad order that affects what the whole city and actually has been held to affect the whole circuit.
And this isn't the first time that this debate has been had. I mean, it's the first time it's reaching the Supreme Court. Given that the Supreme Court receives hundreds, if not thousands, of cases a year to choose from, and you've been a law clerk under a justice, why do you think the Supreme Court chose now to hear a challenge to a 2018 appellate court ruling?
Well, the 2018 appellate court ruling, they didn't take. And then this is a new ruling. This is the one in Grants Pass. And so they had the first opportunity, should we take it? And didn't, because I do think it's a tough question. But then this is, they're being petitioned also, interestingly, as we know, by Democratic governors and mayors who are saying the decision there, while we may well support the right of homeless people and house people to, in fact, not be criminalized if there really is no other option, the way that the courts have been interpreting it has just taken away local discretion so much that they can't serve the public and enforce public health measures and public property measures. So there was much more of an outcry across the board to take the case. And so they did. And certainly when the court takes a case, it's four votes to take it, five to get to a ruling. But I would say that we probably have four votes to modify what the Ninth Circuit said. Five votes, but four to grant it. And that's significant. There was no circuit split. It's just meaning we didn't have courts going different ways. You just had this one ruling that was causing confusion and difficulties according to political leaders.
So if that modification happens come June and it actually favors Grants Pass, for example, I mean, what we're talking about now is the Eighth Amendment, which is cruel and unusual punishment. But are there other constitutional arguments that homelessness advocates could argue for in court?
I think there are. That is, the cruel and unusual punishment clause, again, there is that status case, but it's somewhat of a tough fit. And it's especially a tough fit given the predilections of the majority of the court who don't want to expand this particular right. But for example, there is arguments here about the city aiming to get the homeless people out of the city and foist that problem onto other cities and states. And that's something that these justices might be more sympathetic to. That is, if there's a purpose to export a problem that people should share, that could be a problem. Also, if in fact you have something like a rule about not using blankets, but then it's enforced unequally. That is, people who are homeless have enforcement, but a business person just has a little blanket and sleeps on a bench. That could be something that the justices also would say, you have a pattern here of enforcement that is not even, and so it's not equal. So maybe there are other opportunities to make the argument, if not within this clause of the Constitution.
Professor Jacobs, as always, thank you for the time and the analysis.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Gilo Jacobs is an Anthony Kennedy professor at McGeorge School of Law, who also served as a law clerk to late Supreme Court Justice Louis F.J. Powell, Jr. And just a note, McGeorge School of Law is a financial supporter of CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're unpacking yesterday's Supreme Court case about homeless enforcement when people are sleeping outside. A ruling is not expected until June, but the case could have wide-ranging implications, especially for California. I now want to bring in Marisa Kendall, a homelessness reporter for our content sharing partners at CalMatters. Welcome back, Marisa.
Thanks so much.
So you've been covering this case leading up to yesterday's oral arguments, and we're talking about a case from a small city in southern Oregon. It's about a five-hour drive north from Sacramento. Why is this reverberating across urban metro areas like the Bay Area, Los Angeles, and even here in Sacramento?
Yeah, I mean, arguably, there's nowhere where this is going to be felt more acutely than in California, because we have such a large homeless population, and particularly in our large cities. And in those cities that you mentioned, they have felt the ramifications of the precedent that we've just been talking about. There's been several lawsuits in multiple cities where the district courts have prevented cities or delayed them from clearing encampments, citing some of the prior legal precedent.
How closely is California watching this? I mean, we're talking about what took place at the Supreme Court, but obviously conversations and debates have been pretty robust in the months leading up to the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue, all eyes are on this case, and you can see it in the briefs that have been filed. Everyone from Governor Newsom to the city of Los Angeles to the city of San Francisco have filed briefs in the case, just weighing in and expressing their opinion and urging the justices to go a certain way.
What does Governor Newsom have to say?
His brief was interesting. He was trying to walk a really fine line. He did not side with either party. The last thing that he and other liberal leaders in California want to do is be seen as, quote unquote, criminalizing homelessness. So he took a middle ground approach. He said, we do not support what Grants Pass did. That was wrong to prohibit camping everywhere throughout an entire city, even though you have no shelter. That is wrong. But he also wants cities to have more leeway to punish people for camping.
It seemed interesting to me in the years since Martin versus Boise in that, increasingly over the years, which is could be a rarity in California, you have public and elected officials being vocal about this case, wanting that legal clarity, which is an agreement in one way across party lines. And then, of course, they differ in the details.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that might be partly just a factor of how much more prevalent homeless encampments are now. We are seeing, larger camps becoming more entrenched, and just a lot more pushback against that. So these elected officials are just under a lot of pressure to do something about these camps.
What stands out to you about the city's arguments in California as to why they should be allowed more freedom to enforce anti-camping ordinances?
Yeah, they say, you know, the courts have really tied their hands and prevented them from, Gavin Newsom said, you know, quote unquote, common sense, enforcing common sense ordinances. And they'll argue that these ordinances are needed to protect not only the, you know, housed residents, but also unhoused residents. And they make the case, you know, these encampments are unsafe and unsanitary. And using these ordinances, it's another tool to help try to get people into shelter. You know, advocates will push back on that and say, you know, sweeps don't necessarily lead to housing and shelter. So there's a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a pushback there.
Yeah. If you can unpack more what advocates for the rights of unhoused people, what they're arguing for and also what they're concerned about if there are modifications following the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, so, you know, advocates, unhoused folks I've talked to and experts, you know, in the medical field, mental health field, all say homeless sweeps have really negative consequences for the residents in these encampments. You know, people lose their possessions, they lose, you know, treasured items, they lose medication, medical supplies, they lose things like tarps and blankets that protect them from the elements. So that impacts their physical health. It's traumatic to be constantly having to move and have your things lost. That impacts their mental health. And it also pushes them farther away from the services they rely on. And that's everything from bathrooms and showers to food to outreach workers who help them find housing. So there really are, you know, human costs to these sweeps. And of course, you know, it doesn't end someone's homelessness when you kick them out of their encampment. You know, these are not providing more housing.
And underscoring how complicated this problem is, I mean, when you talk about the human costs of encampments, I would think that businesses, local businesses and neighborhoods would argue that they shoulder a human cost as well, that it impacts their businesses if you have people sleeping outside. How do you understand what, you know, neighborhoods and business communities are advocating for and how they feel, you know, that they're shouldering a large brunt of this crisis?
Absolutely. And you know, that is a real concern. You see that in cities all throughout the state where there are large encampments in front of businesses. You know, sometimes people stop going to those businesses. You know, there's issues of trash and waste, you know, disturbances. The California Chamber of Commerce weighed in with a brief in this case and said, you know, businesses cannot hire or retain employees when encampments pop up near their stores and they lose customers, which, you know, has a real fiscal impact on businesses.
To be clear, and please correct me, I mean, how I understand this case is this case doesn't really address the root causes of homelessness, but more the visibility of homelessness.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't address housing. It doesn't address prevention of homelessness, services, anything like that. It really just addresses how cities manage existing encampments, which, you know, has become extremely important as we start to realize we just don't have enough shelter beds. We don't have enough housing. So we're going to have encampments for the foreseeable future. So, you know, cities are trying to take extra steps to regulate them, to try to legislate, you know, where they can and cannot be. And in some cases, also to try to make life a little more bearable by providing some services to those residents.
Finally, as we wait for that June decision from the Supreme Court, before we let you go, there was another big development here in the state, and it came down to homelessness resources funding in California. As I mentioned early on, California has invested an unprecedented amount of funding in recent years, I believe upwards of $20 billion to this crisis. And state auditors took a hard look at how that money was spent and if it was tracked. What did they find from that audit?
Yeah, you know, that a lot of people were waiting for that audit, and then it came out and they determined we don't really know where that money went, what it was spent on, how much was spent, and if it worked. They analyzed 5 statewide programs, and 3 of those state programs, including the one that provides, you know, the majority of homelessness funding to cities and counties, they said there's just not enough data here for us to even determine whether these programs are working or not. So that created, you know, a lot of anger from people who, you know, want more accountability here.
Was this the first audit of this kind?
Yeah, this was pretty unprecedented in its approach. There was an earlier audit by the California Interagency Council on Homelessness. They were tasked by the legislature with tracking state homelessness spending and determining what was working, but they only did it once, and they have not analyzed any spending since 2021, which is part of the problem here.
Okay, so following this audit, I mean, hopefully it doesn't just exist in a PDF. What does the state, both the governor and lawmakers, cities and counties, what do they do with these findings?
Yeah, so the audit came with some suggestions of ways that the state and the two cities that it audited, San Jose and San Diego, can better track results, which it hopes they implement by September. The audit by itself doesn't have any teeth, but legislators are saying they want to pass some bills that would provide more accountability. And we actually just saw a new bill introduced, AB 2903, which would require agencies involved with homelessness to report more data annually to the state.
And although the state audit doesn't have teeth per se, I mean, state lawmakers have to approve the funding for an audit to take place, correct?
Yes. Yeah. This was introduced by two lawmakers, and then it was the funds for it were approved by the state audit committee last year. And then we finally got the results not too long ago.
And I think that illustrates the political will that there is, because both of those co-authors, weren't they across party lines? Wasn't it a Democrat and a Republican?
It was, yeah. And I think that does illustrate just how much appetite there is for more accountability here. I think legislators and, voters across the board, they see how much money the state is pouring into the homelessness crisis. And then on the street, they don't see any improvement. And I think that's, making them want to demand answers, like, where is this money going?
Yeah, and we don't have a good answer right now, according to that audit. What has Governor Newsom said about this audit following the findings?
He redirected questions to the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and they put out a statement, basically saying, we're continuing to, try to track this. They tried to sort of point a finger at cities, and they said, cities are the ones implementing these programs, so they're responsible for providing the data to us, look at them. They also said, we don't, you gave us funding to do one audit. We don't have funds to continue to analyze these programs.
I go back to the disconnect that you illustrated and laid out, that there's been unprecedented funding, but people don't feel a difference in their daily lives. Do you think that played a role during the primary, Prop 1? It narrowly passed. It was just a sliver of a margin, and it was neck and neck. Do you think that was one way for voters to express their views on how they think the state is responding to homelessness effectively?
Yeah, I think you might be right. I think voters, there might just be some fatigue with spending here and not seeing results. And, it's possible that vote might have turned out differently if this audit had come out before ballots were cast.
Marisa, as always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Marisa Kendall is a homelessness reporter for our content sharing partners at CalMatters. Still ahead, an ongoing exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum looks at the history of tattooed women throughout California. It's called Tattooed and Tenacious. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. An exhibit at the Sacramento History Museum along the waterfront in Old Sacramento is chronicling the stories of tattooed women across California's history. It's called Tattooed and Tenacious, and it runs through June. It highlights how getting inked has a rich history dating back generations, as well as how women both popularized tattoos and they also created opportunities for female artists to leave their mark. It also features some local work and stories from the Sacramento region. The museum's executive director is Delta Pick Mello, and the experience manager is Alexandra Kowalski, and they join us now to shed more light on the stories this exhibit tells. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So tell us a little bit about this exhibit. First and foremost, how did it come about? Who had this idea to profile women and tattoos?
Well, the exhibit is a touring exhibit originally, and it's part of a ongoing change that the Sacramento History Museum is going through in delving into topics that are a little bit more current, more relevant to our communities, our diversity. And so this touring exhibit was called Tattooed and Tenacious, Inked Women in California's History. But we quickly realized that we needed to embellish it with a local aspect. And so we reached out to women and just asked, tell us your stories, either about your tattoos or about being a tattoo artist.
Right. When talking about that evolution that the Sacramento History Museum has been going through, you've joined us before about this, about how, you know, it's not only the gold rush, right?
Exactly. Exactly. We're really trying to show some relevance to the entire Sacramento community, get out of the time frame a little bit, and also reaching out into the outer reaches of our community. And really what we're seeing is just a wonderful response of people coming to the museum that may have never come before.
What caught you most by surprise when taking in this exhibit? Because each one is, you know, unique in its own way.
I think the stories that we heard from the women were just extraordinary. We really didn't know what we would get. And that was the biggest surprise.
Alexandra, you are the experience manager. What goes into being an experience manager at a museum?
It's a very overarching title, but really how you experience the museum just as a public guest coming through our doors is what I try to focus on. So a big part of that with this exhibit was reaching out to our community members, finding ways to capture their stories, capture their images, doing some video recording, and then sharing those in the exhibit.
Was that an easy process? Was it just, you know, I ask and then you got a heavy response, or was it a little bit more work?
Both. So the initial response was huge. We got over 100 different local women sharing their stories. But it was a lot to kind of figure out how to capture all of these different stories with the limited space and resources we had available. And it was also an emotional process. I was really surprised by how vulnerable these women were willing to be with the museum, who many of them had never been before, and sharing these just powerful stories about very personal things in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, tattoos usually have a huge personal significance to you. I mean, you're tattooing yourself in permanent ink. I have tattoos myself. And I remember one time my mother and I, we both got a tattoo for my grandmother, who is Japanese, my mother's mother. And it was a very emotional and powerful experience. What stood out to you about the more than 100 stories you took in about what it meant to these women to tattoo themselves?
Speaking similarly to your experience, there was a woman who reached out that she had lost her sister recently, and she and her three other sisters and mother all got memorial tattoos to honor her, which was a really powerful story. But some other things that really stood out are how women who have struggled with body image issues were using tattoos to kind of take ownership over their own skin and how they present themselves to the world.
Looking at the history component, how far back do we go in history when talking about women and tattoos for this exhibit?
We go way, way back. The exhibit starts out with Indigenous women in the region, and tattooing is a rite that's very personal, that's very much a part of their tribal identity and their place. And it's not something they do lightly. And it's emotional. The people who do the tattooing and how the tattoos are done are very different than the tattooing that we see today. But we start with that. And we talk a little bit about a local tribal member and her story of getting her tattoo. We also then go into Victorian times, and there were rebel women that got tattoos that you would be surprised. Winston Churchill's mother had a tattoo. Amy Crocker, who is the daughter of
the... From, like, the Crocker Museum?
The Crocker Museum. She was quite a rebel, and she was kind of the, maybe the Kardashians of the day. She was a trendsetter, and she lived in the Far East for many years, traveled all over the world, came back with tattoos, scandalized everybody. She thought it was just a lark and hilarious that everybody would be so enamored by this fact. But so we go from there, and then we go into the circus performers of the early 1900s into the 20s and 30s. And out of that era became the tattoo artists, the female tattoo artists. They learned from the men that were tattooing them, and they became tattoo artists unto themselves. And so it kind of goes from there to the tattoo artists that we have in Sacramento were some of the stories we received of this part of this exhibit.
When it comes to the artistry of tattoos, how has that evolved since the late 1800s?
There are definitely some more modern styles coming about, but I think you'll still see some artists in the area that are doing more traditional practices, hand poke techniques, older machinery that they're using. It's really just about the style they're going for, and there's so many options out there. It's been really impressive to see what the artists can do, and I'll admit I'm kind of shopping for my first tattoo now.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that going back to, you know, the Victorian era Harris, Amy Crocker, the daughter of the Crocker Art Museum founders, you know, that there was obviously tattoos were, that's not surprising that tattoos were taboo back then, but they're still taboo to a certain degree today. You know, if I talk to some of my family members, they don't understand why, you know, I would get a tattoo or other people would get tattoos. So it seems as though we may be, you know, a century plus ahead of that era, but the views of tattoos are still kind of the same. And I find that surprising. Did you find that surprising when doing all the research and the work to put this exhibit together?
Yes and no. I think that we are much more accepting of tattoos in this day and age. I remember, you know, when my first jobs, that tattoos and piercing and things were things that were not allowed in the job force. And that isn't something we even think twice about, at least in our industry. The fact that they they're more acceptable is also related to the fact that there are more women now that are, the percentage of women are that are tattooed is higher than the percentage of men.
Really?
Yes. And so I think they really are more accepted. I think there are some, you know, some people that may still be shocked with it, but everyone is tattooed, it just seems like.
I think about it, not only my mom, but my mother-in-law as well. And they got them later in their life. You know, it was something that they, I think, had always wanted to do. But I think that also illustrates and underscores that the changing of the times and the acceptance and them just kind of going for it and doing it. Given that this exhibit has been open now for a few weeks or quite some time, but it's open through June, what have the responses been like? Just watching people take it in and learn about the history of tattoos and women in California.
It's been an overwhelmingly positive response, so much so that we're actually extending the exhibit now through the end of July. So July 28th is the new closing date. But it's brought in a lot of people we don't normally see visiting our museum, and a lot of people are connecting to it on a personal level.
Do you have favorite pieces or photos that really resonate with you?
I think the photography of our contemporary women is just stunning. We worked with Kevin Vieira Photography and Michelle Smith, and the photos that they took of the women, are they captured each each individual woman and her tattoo as part of the storytelling in such a way that is so beautiful and so compelling. Each, you know, it isn't a standard pose for any one of them. And as far as seeing people coming in, the other day there was a woman that came in and she was taking a picture of her two nieces in front of one of the pictures. She said, "That's my sister." You know, we're seeing people coming in because, again, as we've talked about before with other exhibits, we're trying to have a place where people can see themselves. So when they see someone that looks like them or is related to them, but also somebody that shares that same story, that same vulnerability, or that same work that they have. This is what we want to do. We want everybody to come in that museum and find a place for themselves.
Yeah, it seems like it's working. It's taking off, which is amazing. Last 20 seconds or so that we have, it's also Sacramento Photography Month, correct? And the museum is part of that, and I would imagine this exhibit as well.
Absolutely. So we really did want to highlight the work that Kevin and Michelle did for us. These works are truly stunning. I highly recommend everyone in the area gets a chance to come see the exhibit if they can. But we do want to continue more out of just Photography Month, working with these photographers as well as other photographers to highlight how portraiture can really be a way for people that aren't as good with their words to share their stories.
Well, Delta and Alexandra, thank you so much. This was fun.
Thank you.
Delta Picknello is the executive director of the Sacramento History Museum, and Alexandra Kowalski is its experience manager. We've been talking about the ongoing exhibit titled Tattooed and Tenacious, which tells the story of tattooed women across California's history, and it now runs until July 28th. It has been extended. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast, and if you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.